Welcome to Home and Family Finance with Paul Barry. It's your family, it's your finances, and it's your future. Home and Family Finance is sponsored by the Defense Credit Union Council, serving those who serve our country, and by CUNA, the Credit Union National Association. Now, here's the host of Home and Family Finance, Paul Barry.
Welcome, everybody. Nice to be with you here on a wonderful, wonderful summer's day. Where we're almost there. This is June, and I think the 21st is when we can really count ourselves as being in summer. What we can count ourselves as being, in terms of progress, is that we now have two presumptive presidential candidates. And our congratulations to both Donald Trump and also to Hillary Clinton. Now, as you know, on this program, we don't talk politics, only as it relates to your pocketbook. And that'll be the case here in the next few weeks. What I'm going to do is find out as much as I can about each one of these people, each one of these individuals, and find out how they plan to impact the kitchen table issues. And I call them the issues that confront all of us every day of our lives. And we'll learn more about them and maybe get either they or their representatives on to talk to us about what they see and give you the information that can help you make a wise decision. Okay? And I'm looking forward to doing that. But again, congratulations, and we move through the process. We are squarely in the middle of the political silly season. And if you think it's been silly already, you haven't seen anything yet. As these two presumptives now can take aim at each other, and believe me, they're going to do that. In the meantime, we have to deal with things that are important because life goes on. One of the issues that is of most importance is retirement, your retirement, and what you should be doing, what you can be doing, what you are doing. There's a reason why you see all of these ads about when should you start, and because, you know, unless you have other plans, sooner or later you're going to have to look into your retirement fund and decide whether you have made the right decisions. But to make the right decisions, you got to know all the rules. And so today, that's part of what we're going to be talking about. And then we're going to have a special segment that we're going to show, replay for you later in the program. But right now, I'm very pleased to invite to the show Rachel Sheedy. She is editor of Kiplinger's Retirement Report, and she has the 10 things you must know about Social Security's new rules. And I'll bet you a dollar to a donut, most of us don't even know there are new rules out there. We don't think like that unless we are in the process of being impacted. And sooner or later, you're going to be impacted by the rules of Social Security. There's no question about it. And so you must know about them. You must know about those rules. Okay, so we've asked Rachel to join us to talk about that. And Rachel, welcome to Home and Family Finance. We appreciate you being with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Where are you located?
We're in Washington, D.C., not too far from the White House, Capitol Hill, and all that.
All right, not too far from us. So tell me a little bit, get a little background before we get there. How long have you been with Kiplinger?
I've been with Kiplinger for about 13 years, and I've been on Retirement Report for 10 years. So I've been doing retirement issues for quite a while.
You know, and I want to tell the audience right now, because I want them to go to, it's Kiplinger.com, right?
Exactly, Kiplinger.com.
Okay, folks, and there is a wealth of information. I mean, you'll stroll through all kinds of information about retirement, anything you want to know. And Rachel, we thank you because it's right there. All people have to do is to sit down and say, okay, let me review this or review that. And it's there, and it's there, and it's in plain English, and you can learn a lot about it. So thanks for that. I want the audience to know where they can go and find out more. But let's talk about, first of all, who knew that the Social Security made changes? When were these changes made, and why were they made?
Well, so there were a couple of big changes that happened due to the Budget Act that got passed and enacted into law at the end of 2015, around Halloween in November, kind of came up on us all of a sudden, a surprise. But that did away with two claiming strategies that couples in particular could use to boost their total benefits. The two strategies, one was known as file and suspend. The other one was known as restricting an application to spousal benefits. both essentially allowed one spouse to bring in a spousal benefit while the higher earner delayed their benefit to age 70 to earn 8% a year in delayed retirement credits, which is a really valuable thing. So the file and suspend strategy, the benefits of it, no longer exists. That ended as of end of April this year. But a key thing to know is that the restricting and application strategy is still available to some people. So if you were 62 or older as of January 1st of 2016, you can still use that strategy. And so even if you were 62 on January 1st, you have to wait to use the strategy until you hit full retirement age, which for that group would be 66. 4 years from now, you'll be able to use that strategy. Anybody younger, it's no longer an option. It's off the table. But that one small group can still make use of it and to kind of take note and make sure they don't forget to use that if it makes sense for their situation.
Okay, but Rachel, this is everyday stuff to you, but to my audience
right,
and to me,
sure.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, yeah, okay. Sorry. I know. Social Security is complicated. There's no doubt about it.
Listen, we have time to talk about this. I'm going to take a break here. When we come back, let's talk about these things. And I know people are saying, well, no, we really do want you to explain what it is and at least give people the incentive to jump in there and do what they can. My guest, Rachel Sheedy, the editor, Kiplinger's Retirement Report. We'll be right back with more here on Radio America.
We want you to be part of the show. Email us with your financial questions. Ask about the Defense Credit Union Council. Tell us what topics you want to hear about. Or just let us know what's on your mind. We'll give you the address in a few minutes. But now, more of Home and Family Finance with Paul Berry.
My guest is Rachel Sheedy. She is the editor of Kiplinger's Retirement Report. And there are some changes that were made by the Social Security. And I presume these changes are made. Who requests these changes, or does the Social Security folk just look around and say, this would be better? How does that happen, Rachel?
That's a very good question. Can I tell you exactly? I'm not sure. But, I think it was part of the Obama administration it was in Obama's budget proposal for a couple of years to nix these strategies. There were concerns that people were sort of taking advantage of the system. They were legal moves that people could make, so, it wasn't illegal to do. But they were unintended loopholes from a previous law.
Okay.
Social Security, I think, was glad to get rid of them as well. Basically, they're simplifying the rules for everybody and trying to level the playing field.
Okay. You told me that the file and suspend strategy, it's ended now. You can't avail yourself of that. Is that right?
Well, so the benefits that used to exist to do that, most of the benefits have gone away as of the end of April. The actual technical strategy still does exist, and there are people who might make use of it. You can claim Social Security as early as age 62.
Okay.
If you do that, you'll take a big permanent reduction. But one possible do-over, say you claimed at 62, you've hit full retirement age, you regretted that you took that reduction, that you took it early, you can voluntarily suspend your benefits, and you can earn the delayed retirement credits, which are worth up to 8% a year if you wait to take your benefit to restart it at age 70.
Okay, so to understand that, then, if I decide to, I filed early, but I've taken a reduction in my amount, but if I go back to not filing and I guess pay in or whatever, the next time when I get 65, I'll get the full benefit. Am I saying that correctly?
Well, sort of. So if you have to be, full retirement age is currently 66.
Okay.
It's going to be climbing to 67, but right now it's 66. And so you would just suspend your benefit. So you would no longer get monthly payments until you restart it, and then when you restart it later, you'll get more money.
Okay, so if I have, if I don't need it, it might be the way to have a larger payment later, not take it early. That's basically right.
Exactly. That's another way. You could just wait till full retirement age, or you could just wait till age 70 to take your benefit. I wanted to mention there is one other do-over opportunity. Say that you've claimed your benefit early, and maybe you even claimed it at 66, but you decided, oh, I wish wish I had waited till 70. You can withdraw your application within 12 months of first filing for your benefit. Mm-hmm. You have to pay back any benefits that you've received, and including any spousal benefits coming off your record. But if you pay it back within that 12-month time period, then you can restart later at a higher amount. So kind of early claimers get kind of two do-over opportunities. So it's something to look into if you've taken benefits.
What if let's assume, Rachel, that I'm 66, I'm qualified, I could, right?
Yes.
But I decide, no, I'm not, I'm making money, I'm doing whatever I'm doing. So I'm not gonna file for Social Security until I'm 72. Am I going to get more money if I do that?
So don't wait till 72. Wait until 70. You can earn extra credits from full retirement age up to age 70. By the time you turn age 70, there's no extra bonus to waiting. So you definitely want to claim your benefit at 70 if you've delayed. But it's a very smart strategy to do, actually, particularly for the high earner of a couple, because that larger boosted benefit will become the survivor benefit for whichever spouse, you know, lasts the longest.
Right, right.
Who lives the longest.
And speaking of that survivor and the survivor spouse, for the two of you, and you're getting a benefit on a monthly basis, and one or the other dies, how long does the benefit continue for the survivor spouse?
The lifetime of the surviving spouse.
Okay.
So say I'm the husband, I'm the higher earner, I've waited till 70 to boost the benefit. I die first. My wife then takes a survivor benefit, and let's say she lives to, you know, age 95, which is not necessarily uncommon these days, that boosted benefit will last decades, and it can really be an instrumental key factor in, you know, providing for a survivor.
Absolutely, absolutely, because I know a lot of people think that when you die, when one or the other dies, the benefit stops, but in this case, the survivor benefit would continue to the surviving spouse until he or she died.
Exactly. And basically, it's going to be the higher benefit. So if you have a couple who's a higher earner and a low earner, when the low earner takes their benefit is a little bit less important.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can wait for that higher earner to take until 70, you can really, you know, secure your
make a difference. Earner. My guest is someone who knows what she's talking about, Rachel Sheedy with the Kiplinger. She is the editor of Retirement Report. When we come back, we'll talk more, ask the question that you know you want to know the answer to. Be like me, it's difficult to even figure out how to ask them. We'll be right back. You're listening to Radio America. I'm your host, Paul Berry, and we thank you so much for joining us. Our program sponsor, the Defense Credit Union Council, and we thank them for their continued support of the program, dedicated to making all of us smarter consumers. And if there's a topic or subject that you want to discuss, please write to me here, Paul Berry at Radio America, 1100 North Glebe Road, Suite 900, Arlington, Virginia, 22201. Or you may go to our website, which is www.hffradio.com. We always like to hear from you. The Defense Credit Union Council and its member credit unions believe that financial readiness equals mission readiness and supports the efforts of Military Saves in their dedication to improving the financial well-being of our troops wherever they may be. Military Saves is a year-round campaign that seeks to motivate, support, and encourage military families to save money, to reduce debt, and to build wealth. As part of the Department of Defense Financial Readiness Campaign, Military Saves acts as a resource center for information on financial education and counseling. Check out its links to useful websites for military families where they can learn better money management and can find the partners who can help military members achieve their financial goals. Military Saves. Set a goal, make a plan, save automatically, and go to militarysaves.org for more information. And by all means, take the Savers Pledge today. And as we always say, you don't have to be in the military to be a good saver. As a matter of fact, you should be saving at least 5% of your income each month. And if you do that, at a certain time in your life, you're going to say, boy, Mr. Berry, thank you so much for reminding me to do that. It's made a big difference in our lives. We're talking about retirement, which is where most of us are headed. With the recent changes to Social Security rules, many Americans nearing retirement find themselves in a heap of confusion when planning how they will claim their benefits. Kiplinger Report, Retirement Report editor Rachel Sheedy, is joining us here to help these near retirees make the best financial decisions regarding the benefits that you have. And there are some things that you must know about Social Security. So, Rachel, we've talked about the file and suspend. We've talked about waiting until you're 65. What are the other changes or rules? What should we know that's going to make us happy when we get to that point?
You know, one thing we talked about that it's a lifetime benefit, it's actually a lifetime inflation-adjusted benefit, and really like an annuity. It's a really a key part of it. There's an annual cost of living adjustment that's announced in October for the following year. In recent years, we've had a couple years where it's been zero, which has been a little bit hard for some people to deal with, but the announcement of what it is based on, you know, changes in inflation and prices. So technically, it should keep up with, you know, prices.
Yeah.
So that is a huge benefit.
All right, and we're not talking about a get rich here. I mean, it's just an adjustment to reflect how much more it does cost to live on an annual basis. Is that basically what it is?
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, what are the other? There are other changes. I mean, I don't know these changes, so I'm counting on you. What other change should I know about a retirement change that's going to make a difference in my life, or could do?
Well, the changes from the Budget Act are really the biggest ones, and I think the key thing to know is, you know, there are some things that haven't changed. We talked about the higher earner delaying their benefit. That still exists, and it's a really critical strategy that couples should consider. The restricting an application strategy, you know, hits a certain group of people. People who are 62 or older as of January 1st of 2016 can still make use of that. And that strategy allows a person to, at full retirement age, apply for benefits, but just for the spousal benefit only, and they can let their own grow until age 70. A critical thing to note with that, too, is that ex-spouses can also make use of that. So if you are 62 or older as of January 1st or 2016, you were divorced for at least 10 years, and you meet some other qualifications, mm-hmm. You can, you know, just get that spousal benefit right now and let your own grow to help boost your retirement security.
So, Rachel, if I have questions about any or all of this, where do I go to find? I mean, I know you've got online, you've got that Boomer's Guide to Social Security. Is that a place to go to kind of ask and answer questions that may come up as we get closer to retirement?
Well, so you can go to Kiplinger.com has a special report on maximizing Social Security benefits, and all of our Social Security coverage is housed there. So if you want to find that specifically, go to that part of our website. Kiplinger.com/retirement houses all our retirement coverage. If you subscribe to Retirement Report, we answer readers' questions, and Social Security questions tend to be a lot of those make up most of our questions. It's a very complicated process, and the rules are complicated. People don't really pay attention to it until they get close to the time that they need to take it.
Yeah.
So it's a whole new world that people have to deal with.
Rachel Sheedy, you've made this seem like I can understand it. Thank you so much for taking time. I know it's busy, but I really appreciate you coming on to talk to us about it. Come back again as we go through the process and help us understand it, okay?
Will do. Thank you for having me.
You bet. Rachel Sheedy, my guest. Folks, we're coming back in just a minute. We have a special one of the segments that we want to repeat for you that we think you'll enjoy. This is Home and Family Finance. I'm your host, Paul Berry, here on the Radio America Network. I'll be right back.
Helping you be safe, smart, and secure with your finances. Welcome back to Home and Family Finance with your host, Paul Berry.
You know, spring is just around the corner, folks. That means spring break. That means we're heading into the warmer climes, the months when we plan on taking trips. And if you're planning or making a trip or making it a family trip this year, you may, according to the latest Kiplinger report, the one done just now by Miriam Cross, one of their editors, you might want to find out the newest developments for frequent flyers. Now, everybody knows what the frequent flyer miles are. Okay, you get so many miles, you travel and you pay, and you get so many miles back from the airline. And for the most part, they work pretty much the same. But more and more U.S. airlines are now awarding miles. Do you know what they were? Let me ask you this. Are the miles based on how far you're flying or on how much you're paying? Have you ever asked that question? And do you know the answer to that? Do they give you miles based on how far you fly or how much you pay, how much you spend on your ticket? Well, certainly Miriam Cross knows the answer. She's Kiplinger's personal financial editor, and her resume is long and very impressive. I won't trust me, if you're working for Kiplinger, you've got to be somebody, and she certainly is. She lived in Toronto, Canada before joining Kiplinger. Prior to that, she freelanced as a fact checker for several Canadian publications, including Reader's Digest Canada, Style at Home, and Air Canada En Route, and spent a year traveling and working in New Zealand, of all places. She received a BA from the University of Toronto with a major in English Literature and is completing a certificate in magazine and web publishing at Ryerson University. That's according to her bio. Is all of that true, Miriam?
Yes, it is all true.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining us. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great. I enjoyed the article. And so I posed the question, what is the answer?
So increasingly, you're earning miles based on how much you spend on your ticket, not how far you fly. At least with U.S. airlines, the discount carriers tend to award you miles based on how much you spend. United and Delta do that. And this month, American will also switch over to the revenue-based system. It's really Alaska Airlines that's the last major holdout of American-based airlines that still awards you based on how far you fly.
So what they're really saying is this is going to be truly revenue-based. You pay the dollars, we give you some miles. I mean, that's what they're saying, right?
Right. So if you spend more on your ticket, if you have to splurge on a last-minute ticket, or if you're paying a lot just to fly over state lines, you're getting more miles back. But if you score this amazing $500 fare to, I don't know, Japan, then you're not going to earn as many miles as you would have in the past.
Well, from your perspective, which one is the most fair to the customer? I mean, are customers winning or losing in this deal?
So leisure travelers are definitely losing in this deal because leisure travelers, definitely like me, I'm always more interested in finding the lowest fare. I'm not going to spend more just to earn more miles. Business travelers or first class travelers, they'll actually win out a bit in this. Because in the past, they would have earned the same amount as a leisure, as an economy class flyer just for flying the same distance. Now they're spending more on their ticket, and they'll earn more as a result. But yeah, leisure travelers, like most of us, we're losing out here.
It would seem, and again, maybe it's not true, but it would seem that the airlines think that they can make more money by doing it this way. Or am I missing something? What's driving them to do this?
It's a way to drum up business. U.S. airlines, it's not like they have to spend so much on marketing or making it comfortable. They're already getting the passengers, and this is just a way to get more revenue.
So they make more money, I guess. Miriam, is this a win-win situation for the airlines? I mean, by giving up these seats and giving up, and they've had plenty of time, are they making, does this make money for the airlines, this frequent flyer program, or does it cost them money?
I would imagine it makes the money or they wouldn't be doing it this way.
So your position is, look, they're making money in some form or fashion. But, you know, I don't know how I guess it must be enough of a draw to offer a ticket or offer, you know, tickets for flying frequently. That ultimately it must make money for them. I just don't see how that happens when they're giving up seats that they could get full fare for.
I mean, sometimes, you know, when you're a traveler, you don't really have a choice. You need to fly places, so, you know, you have to look to other ways to earn your miles.
Okay. All right. So at any rate, is this change already taking place or is it underway? And if it is, how long have they been doing it this way?
So Delta and United have been doing it for about the last couple years. American Airlines, it's actually a pretty recent thing. It's this month, I believe March 22nd, that they're switching over to the revenue-based system.
All right. And parenthetically, have nothing to do with the miles and everything. Can you explain to me, and we're talking with somebody who might know the answer to Miriam Cross, Kiplinger editor. You know, Miriam, I remember when the price of gasoline was sky high. It's now down to $30 a barrel or whatever. And airlines are having a field day because they're paying so little. And yet, I read last month a couple of the carriers actually raised their tickets by $14. How's that possible? I mean, what's going on here? Said another way, is the public getting ripped off here?
I'd say with domestic airlines, yes, they are. It's World Airlines are actually just known for having better service, and a lot of World Airlines actually are still on this distance-based system. So if you can, you know, if you're flying on partner, like, you know, flying on United,
right,
if you can accumulate miles in, say, like a Singapore Airlines account, you'll definitely be getting more bang for your buck.
And again, I mean, everybody wants to pay as little as possible, I presume, except the very, very wealthy. And I know that you travel a lot. So how do you find, how do you go about finding the lowest fares? What do you do? Well, hold that. Let me just pay the bill. Let me stop, take a break. And when we come back, I'll ask Marion, because she would know and can tell you how to find possibly the lowest fares as you head into the summer season. This is Home and Family Finance here on the Radio America Network. I'm your host, Paul Berry. We'll be right back.
You to be part of the show. Email us with your financial questions. Ask about the Defense Credit Union Council. Tell us what topics you want to hear about, or just let us know what's on your mind. We'll give you the address in a few minutes. But now, more of Home and Family Finance with Paul Berry.
All right, my guest is Miriam Cross. She is an editor with Kiplinger. The headline here, folks, is that the airlines have made a change. They are now, without question, charging or providing you frequent flyer miles, or whatever they call them, based on how much you spend and not on how far you fly. So, you know, if you're going around the world, don't think, oh, my God, I'm going to make a lot. No, that's not what you're going to make some. You're going to get some mileage, but that's not what they're going to base it on. They're basing it on what you pay for that actual ticket. Okay, that's the headline. Now, you're looking, and all of us are. I mean, you want to get the best possible fare that you can get. And I've asked Miriam to consider talking a little bit about how she goes about finding the lowest fares. What's the secret to this, or is there a secret to it, Miriam?
I wouldn't say there's a secret to it. There's different ways to do this. I'm a big fan of Google Flights as a search engine. It's really fast. It's really intuitive. It ranks the flights, taking into account price and distance and stopovers. It has these like great tools to compare different dates. You can click on a calendar and see which date combinations are cheaper. You can click on a map and show which cities are cheaper. So Google Flights is a great one. You can also follow your favorite airlines on Twitter. Sometimes they'll post flash sales,
mm-hmm,
or sign up for airfare alerts with airfarewatchdog.com. Enter in your cities, and they'll send you alerts when the price hits a certain point.
Okay, so just keep an eye out. In this Google thing, you can go there and just they kind of summarize everything that's going on through their website. Is that what they do?
So it's google.com/flights. Okay. And that takes you right to their search engine.
Okay. Well, there you have. So you should use the web to search for flights. And I think it's worth the time. Would you say it is worth the time if you're looking for bargains and deals to just search and find? What about Kayak and all these other sites that say they can get tickets free? Are not free, but cheaper tickets. Do they work?
Certainly do, and some people definitely prefer Kayak. I think it's actually great too. You might want to compare a few search engines like Kayak and Google Flights and HipMonk. If you cover all three, each one might pull up flights that the other one missed.
Okay. Now here's an issue that you may help me with. My wife was planning to travel this month to visit our son in Thailand. Okay,
mm-hmm.
And so I bought the tickets a month ago or so from Emirates, mm-hmm. Emirates Airline. Then she went to have her foot checked. She had surgery in December early. And they had to, as a matter of fact, even as we speak right now, she's undergoing surgery. And I now have to go and try to figure out, because I bought a nice cheap ticket, obviously, you know, the one that says no money back, nothing. I got a note from the doctor that says she had to have surgery. Will that help me? Or what's your advice as to how I can change? I don't want money back. I just want to change to a different date. Without having
right.
to pay the fine. What do you think?
So you might have to pay a change fee. If you bought travel insurance, then having that note could help you get money back for the change fee. If not, you might just have to pay whatever Emirates charges for the change fee. And you know, it's annoying to have to pay those things, but unfortunately, they're just a reality of flying nowadays.
Yeah, do they care whether or not I have a note from the doctor that says she actually had? I mean, that's why I guess my question is: would a note like that make a difference? I guess it depends on the airline. What do you think?
I think it depends. I think you would have to just try your best and, you know, appeal to them and say you have the note.
Yeah,
it's always worth giving it a shot.
Yeah, just at least try to see, and if they say no, I guess you have no choice but to pay the change fee or lose your ticket, right?
Right, unless you bought travel insurance, in which case they might pick up the change fee cost.
Are you said that the second time about? Are you suggesting that travel insurance is always good to have on? I guess any travel.
I mean, I'm personally a fan. It's definitely helped me in the past, but it's also a very personal decision. I know some people feel like it's not worth the risk, so I just say it's a personal decision. For me, it's really not that much money, and you get all these benefits from medical to interruption to cancellation.
Okay. Is there one company better than the other, and how much does it cost?
Oh, my God. It varies so much. The best thing you can do is go to an aggregator such as InsureMyTrip or SquareMouth.com and, you know, type in your dates and some information. And
Miriam, you say this stuff. You say this stuff like everybody knows how to do.
No.
Look, what's an aggregator? What is that? What are you talking about?
It's a website that it's like a search engine. It sort of pulls together policies from a whole bunch of different companies.
Oh, okay.
So you can use that to compare different policies.
And what's that called? Where would I go? Tell me again.
A couple are InsureMyTrip.com and SquareMouth.com.
Okay. And I guess the other good advice we would say to people today is book as far out as you can. I mean, that's how you really can save a lot of money, by buying a ticket for today and making sure, you know, you're traveling, I guess, when as far out as you can.
It's funny. I not always. I feel like there's definitely, I mean, you'll see articles all the time talking about a sweet spot. Maybe it's 2 months in advance. Maybe it's 3 months in advance, depending on where you're flying. Because sometimes if you book way too far out, the fares aren't actually that cheap. I would actually monitor them once you know your dates. I would actually monitor them, like, you know, every couple of weeks, because they could fall closer, you know, maybe 2 or 3 months out from when you're flying versus 6 months out.
Okay. And you also mentioned that you could chat a little bit about crediting miles to partner airlines.
Mm-hmm.
What is that?
So this is a good strategy for leisure travelers who, especially with this new revenue-based system, aren't going to be earning miles as quickly as they would with the distance-based systems. So Alaska Airlines is a great example. They still award miles based on distance, and they partner with Delta and with American Airlines. So if every time you fly Delta or American, you enter your Alaska Airlines frequent flyer number, you'll accumulate all your miles in an Alaska account, which will help you earn miles faster, earn status faster, and then you can get some benefits on its partners.
Okay, I got it. Okay, so there are lots you should check. Folks, I guess with Miriam, and not guess, she's saying, look, check out. Don't just, you know, see what's out there, what's available, and how you can save as much money and make as many miles as possible. When we come back, we're going to talk about that pre-TSA, or is it TSA pre-al, whatever it is. I think you want to know about it, because it can save you a lot of hassle. This is Hope and Family Finance. I'm Paul Barry. This is Hope and Family Finance. I'm your host, Paul Barry, here on the Radio America Network. My guest is Miriam Cross. She is an editor with Kiplinger Online, and we're talking about this new kind of integrated rule with all the airlines, where they're actually now going to charge you for or provide you with ticketing with these frequent flyer miles, or whatever you call it, not on how much you spend, not on how far you fly, folks, but rather on how much you spend. That counts. And it's a little bit different in terms of how it adds up. So you should be aware of that. And you can ask those questions when you talk to the airline of your choice. I've asked my engineer here, Al Peterson, to join in with Miriam as we talk about something that impacts all of us to some degree. I don't know whether you've been flying recently, but as you know, the security system or whatever they call it. After you get your ticket, that's one line you got to get in. Then you got to get into a second line, and that's a security line where you have to go through. What do they call it, Al? That's the, those machines.
That's before they screen you, right?
Yeah, the screen.
Hold your arms up, stand still.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And everybody, Miriam, I know you've done it 1,000 times in your trip. Mm-hmm. You go through the screening, right? You got to do it.
Yep.
Okay. Have you noticed that there's some people that don't go in the line that you go in? They go in a different line. Have you seen that?
I have occasionally been randomly pulled aside and have been able to go through the TSA pre-check line.
Do you know what it is?
Yeah, it's an expedited security service. So if you pay $85 and you have to apply, you pay $85. It covers 5 years. You get a bunch of benefits when you're going through security. You don't have to take off your shoes. You don't have to unpack all of your bags. It goes faster.
Wow.
So it's a great way to save time. I'd actually, my piece of advice there actually is, instead of applying for TSA PreCheck, I would look into Global Entry, which is the customs program that gets you expedited entry when you're coming back into the U.S. and going through customs lines. But it also frequently gets you TSA PreCheck benefits as well. So you're only paying $15 more over those 5 years, and you get all these extra benefits.
Okay, I consider myself not a frequent flyer, but a regular. You know, I fly pretty often.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever heard of? Am I in the dark here? Have you heard about this?
I haven't heard about this, but there are times I travel with ham radio equipment, and I have to take a second line anyway because I have to tell them ahead of time. Look, if you X-ray my bag, you're going to see wires, you're going to see weird electronic
right.
devices, and I'm going to save you the trouble now. Let's just move over here. Let's just go through my bag so I can tell you what I got. I can show you what I got,
yeah.
And to me, actually, it's funny because the line moves faster. If I was standing in line, because I have to have a special search for my gear.
Sure. So it works to your advantage.
Yeah, but again, right. It does. It means I got to get to the airport, a week in advance. But still, in all.
Yeah, and Miriam, the reason I bring this up is that I've had more and more people either stop me while I'm in the line and say to me, they'll say, "How come you're not over there? You're some kind of television or media star." And I said, "Do you think the TSA cares about that? They don't care. Mm-hmm. Do you think they care that Miriam Cross writes for? They don't care. So I'm asking the question, or they're asking me, how do we get into that line? So the last time I was at the airport, flying out of BWI, and by the way, Miriam, something interesting happens every now and then on my ticket. It says pre-TSA. And I didn't know how that happened. So I went, they said, "Well, it's random." But the day that I was at the airport, they said, "Well, yeah." And you hit it right on the head. You can go in and you go online, go to TSA, Transportation Security Administration, and you can apply for this, folks. And you have to fill out this. It's about it takes you about 10 minutes to go through it. And then, Miriam, after the end of all of that, they say, "Okay, here's what you got to do. Where do you live?" And then they'll send you to the nearest area where you can be fingerprinted, folks. You have to be fingerprinted, and you have to bring along a passport. And then, Miriam, they do exactly what you just said they do. You have to pay how much?
For TSA PreCheck only, it's $85 for 5 years.
That's right. And is that refundable?
It's not.
No, folks. No, here's the deal.
So they could turn you down?
Yes.
Really?
Yes, they can. And I want you to hear, they can turn you down. I don't think they're in the business of doing that. But if they turn you down, and you have to wait until they clear you, but if they turn you down for whatever reason, you don't get your $85 back. So just be – but on the other hand, the next time you're at the airport and you whiz through that little pre-TSA line – you're going to think that's the best $85 you ever spent. Yeah. Isn't that true, Mary? Because you can stand in that line for a long, long time. Anyway, listen, it's a pleasure having you on the show. Come back and see us again and keep us up to date on what's happening with the airline industry, would you?
Yeah, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Miriam Cross, our guest from Kiplinger. Al, thanks for joining in here, because I can always count on you to know what's going on. Anyway, we'll be back next week with the same thing here on Radio America. This is Home and Family Finance. I'm your host, Paul Berry. See you in a week.